Well, first of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to present this work, and also the organizers of the workshop for a great workshop, and also allowing me to come back to Santa Barbara, which is always a treat, and actually always particularly productive. What I'll tell you about here was done in collaboration with these fine gentlemen. Zhao, who's in the audience, who is a postdoc here. Jason, who moved to Boulder, was a student here. Leo Monjal, who's also sitting in the audience and who's my student. And Leon, who's also here. So the idea of this, not Jason, I guess. Yeah. So the idea of the, first of all, let me introduce, because everything will be about thermal conductivity, so let me introduce thermal conductivity so we're all on the same page. So what is it? Well, it basically is a way to measure how the energy density flows when applying a temperature gradient to a system. And so it is very much analogous to what the electrical conductivity is, provided you replace the potential, electrical potential, by the temperature, and the electric current by the thermal current or energy density current. Okay. And here I want to talk to you about the thermal conductivity in the context of magnetic insulators. So insulators in general, there will be no electrons flowing around. And the reason for this work was motivated by the vastly increasing number of experiments, motivated in part by quantum spin liquids, i.e. one is trying to look for new probes to probe excitations that are hard to see, for example, with neutrons because of their fractional nature. And there's been many claims because in these experimental papers trying to understand what the features seen in these experiments were, because there's not very much theory so far, and so theory really does need to be developed. Of course, as you'll see in Yuji's talk tomorrow, there was also much excitement generated by this observation of this quantized thermal Hall conductivity in alpha ruthenium trichloride, which may be a sign of the quantum spin liquid phase in an applied field described by Kitaev, where the quantization of the Hall conductivity is due to these Majorana edge states propagating along the edge of the sample in this quantum spin liquid phase. However, I do want to emphasize that the quantization of the thermal Hall conductivity in this kind of system is entirely specific to this kind of system. I don't want to lead you to believe that one should expect to see a thermal Hall conductivity in every single quantum spin liquid. It is basically not the case at all. But in this case, this quantized Hall thermal conductivity is actually a smoking gun signature of this quantum spin liquid, and this is very rare. So what is thermal conductivity good for? Well, one aspect of it is that it is extremely long wavelength, low frequency, so it probes very collective behavior. And in fact, this is the reason why it can possibly probe topological features of a material, because it probes the system as a whole. It probes all mobile excitations, so of course it can probe electrons, phonons, but also spins and spin-ons. And so it probes a lot of things, which can actually be a disadvantage. But one advantage compared to other thermodynamic measurements is that it does not see local excitations which do not propagate. So for example, any disorder or nuclear-induced local excitations, what I'm thinking about here is, for example, the things related to the Schottky anomaly, won't be picked up by thermal conductivity, and so that won't be a bother, because this is the kind of thing that we're not so interested about. And while it probes all mobile excitations, which are can be well defined, it is also just as effective without quasiparticles. So it can probe systems which don't have well-defined quasiparticles, both at low temperature, if the low temperature state doesn't have good quasi-particles, or at high temperatures where they're no longer well-defined. Another important aspect of thermoconductivity is that one can access the whole tensor. So it's not just one quantity, but actually several quantities, which grow if you are in higher dimension. And one particularly interesting component of the thermoconductivity is actually the anti-symmetric part of the conductivity. And this, of course, should remind you, you should expect this to be true thanks to what you know about the Hall conductivity in electrical systems. The reason for this is that actually one can show that the Hall conductivity is isentropic. And it could be a topological, as I mentioned before, in relation to just like in the electrical Hall conductivity. One important feature, which can be both good and bad, once again, is that it requires time reversal breaking and spin orbit coupling. So it does not exist because of some symmetry constraints. It cannot exist in any system, and the magnitude of the Hall conductivity will be also constrained by this, by the magnitude of these things. Okay, very good. So why are there not many theories? And why is it hard theoretically, i.e. why hasn't it been solved already? Well, let's compare with electrical conductivity. So most calculations of electrical conductivity are carried out assuming the existence of quasi-particles. And the reason is that most metals are actually Fermi liquid, so they're good quasi-particles, which don't scatter actually all that much, so one can define a velocity, and so one can use the Boltzmann equation. And one reason for this is that the experimental, the temperatures at which one makes measurements are basically up to 300 Kelvin, and that's much, much lower than the Fermi energy which one could compare to, which is of about 10,000 Kelvin. Okay. So we have good quasi-particles, we can use Boltzmann equation, and we can solve for the electrical conductivity in the Fermi liquid. However, in magnets, the situation is extremely different. Basically, one can consider that almost all the time there are no good quasi-particles. And the reason for this is that in magnets, the exchange energy and the nail temperature for a system that which orders is actually, you know, a maximum, say, 1,000 Kelvin, so that when one actually measures a system, most of the experimental temperature range actually is a temperature range which is at nominally high temperatures for magnets. And so there are no good quasi-particles, and then essentially most of the time using Boltzmann equation fails, and so one has to resort to other techniques which are much more expensive computationally. There have been, and so in this case, I'm also in particular thinking about quantum spin liquids, which may have will not have well-defined quasi-particles, or which may have well-defined quasi-particles, but we don't know what those are. There have been, of course, calculations already. It's not like we're doing here something entirely new in terms of topics. The usual quasi-particle transport would be magnon transport. In that case, they're indeed quasi-particles, but this is really not very lit very often. It's only true if one has an ordered state and one is at very low temperatures. Okay. There's been this very important non-magnon transport theory paper in dimensions higher than one, which is this paper here, and which achieves several things. It formulates the thermal Hall effect, and it calculates the Hall conductivity for partons, so in a spin liquid phase that is assumed here, using the quasi-particle basis. However, there are various limitations, and so one needs to do more work. Basically, in order to carry out this calculation, the authors focused on orbital coupling to B, which is very weak, actually, in most magnets. The important coupling is a Zeeman coupling. The quasi-particle assumption is often not valid. And finally, several approximations, including mean field, have not been tested. So I'll explain how you go beyond this, and also I'll talk about phonons, which are, of course, very important in magnets. So the first part of the talk will be discussing how to calculate thermal conductivity and some results that one can generally obtain in the absence of quasiparticles. And finally, I'll discuss phonon transport in magnets. So one way to go beyond quasiparticles is to use some theory which doesn't require the use of quasiparticles. And actually, Leidinger, a long time ago, proved the existence of a Kubo formula, which means that it's just a formula which is based purely on linear response, which relates the thermal conductivity to the current-current correlation integral of the current-current correlation functions. Okay? And you'll notice that this looks actually very much like the electrical conductivity Kubo formula, except that there is a 1 over t coefficient here. And I want to emphasize that actually it's really not trivial that there should exist a Kubo formula for thermal conductivity, because actually T is a thermodynamic quantity and it is only defined in equilibrium. So that's quite different from actually the electrical potential. But nevertheless, it's a very nice paper and he was able to prove the existence of this Kubo formula. Then one can actually rewrite this formula in the spectral decomposition, and it can be very useful actually to carry out this in order to prove various properties of the thermal conductivity. Here I've shown these formulas both for the longitudinal conductivity, i.e. the symmetric part of the thermal conductivity, and the anti-symmetric part of the conductivity, the Hall conductivity. So some of the things that one can prove using these formulas is that a non-vanishing thermal Hall conductivity, as I mentioned before, requires both time reversal and spin orbit coupling. This is related to the existence of some anti-unitary symmetries, which exist if these are not broken. And finally, one can derive the Onsager relations. That is, the longitudinal current should be proportional to the real part of the current-current correlations, and the Hall current should be related to the imaginary part of those. Okay. All right. So you'll have noticed, I mentioned before, that if you actually want to do this, carry out this calculation, you need to define a current. But so far, I haven't told you how to define a current if you don't have good quasiparticles, i.e. no velocity. Okay. So one way to do this is, so if you want to define a current, actually, you should also be able to define an energy density. And this is always possible because the locality of the Hamiltonian actually requires that it is a sum. The Hamiltonian takes the form of a sum of local energy density terms. And so one can define the energy density operator this way, and there will be some choice, which, as we'll see in a second, will be very, one choice can be made very natural for corner-sharing lattices. In order to then define the current, one actually uses Noether's current from energy conservation, and then one can access the divergence of such a current. And then using Heisenberg's equation of motion, one can finally relate the divergence of the current to the commutators, basically, of energy densities at different points. There's actually some choices that need to be made. You need to choose how your clusters are defined for the define your local energy density, and also actually the continuity equation relates the divergence of the current and not the current itself to these operators here. It turns out that there's a very natural definition for corner-sharing lattices. Those are, for example, the Kagame and the Pyrochlore lattices, because they naturally define local clusters through the, for example, in the Kagame lattice, through the local triangles here. And in that case, little algebra actually will show you that the current is the sum of the commutators between the energy densities defined on the different plaquettes, which only overlap through the corner terms here. And so we'll take this definition for the for the current density on the Kagome lattice, and then we can plug this into Kubo's formula. If you do this, actually, and you can do this for any Hamiltonian, here, nearest neighbor Hamiltonian, with any kind of asymmetric couplings, you can get an answer, which I've presented here only for the Heisenberg model because the general formula has a lot of indices and it's kind of hard to digest. But basically, what you end up with is actually that the current defined at the center of each triangle takes the form of S times this other thing here, and it basically takes the form of a velocity times an energy. So it is kind of that's just a dimensional analysis, and it is kind of, it can remind you of what it would be for a system with actual quasi-particles, where the current is just the velocity times the energy of these quasi-particles. Except this is for strongly interacting systems, and it is very, very general. So from this, very, very general formula, plugging this back into the Kubo formula, one can see, one can do a little bit of scaling, and actually what one finds is that the thermal conductivity goes as one over T squared, and that the transverse conductivity goes as B times 1 over T squared. And actually, what we've done with my collaborators is to check, and so that was essentially Zhao's work, was to check that these functions here, that are scaling functions, actually are finite with numerics, which then implies that indeed at high temperatures here, you're going to have this scaling behavior. And again, here I've made no assumption, basically, about the Hamiltonian, almost no assumptions anyway, so that this is extremely general. Okay. So one will expect that the intrinsic part of the thermal conductivity at high temperature scales in this way. Moreover, again, using some scaling arguments, and because there are no other orders of magnitude in the system, one can go even further and actually draw a shape of what the thermal conductivity should look like. So what you know here is that there's this 1 over T squared behavior of the thermal conductivity at high temperature. What you should expect also is that it should vanish at zero temperature, because there the entropy is very small and you have Einstein's relations. And so they expect that there should be a peak in the middle if two quantities go to zero at two ends of a spectrum. And this peak actually should scale, should the height of this peak should be of order the exchange constants in appropriate units. Okay. And this basically, this peak will separate a region which is typically mostly not quasi-particle behaviors, except in some very specific systems, and regions where it definitely is not quasi-particle behavior because it is high temperature. Okay. So I promised that there are going to be some numerical results derived by Zhao and Jason. And so they analyzed this model, which is a very general spin-orbit coupled model on the Kagome lattice, and indeed, we're able to extract this behavior, the linear, so this 1 over T squared dependence, from which we were able to extract the prefactors, as well as the linear scaling in small h of the Hall conductivity, which is also what is expected, and another result came from was the sign of the Hall effect, which is non-trivial for thermal conductivity in magnets. These results were carried out on very small systems, 2x2 systems. And the reason that this is very difficult is because you actually need to diagonalize the whole system. And so your system, so diagonalization requires the full spectrum, and so you can only do small system sizes. And so in order to go to go to larger systems, to exclude finite sets, et cetera, one needs to develop other methods. So what Zhao carried out was exact diagonalization plus time evolution, which allows you to diagonalize on the system only around, around a small temperature window, and also some other calculation based on the eigenstates thermalization hypothesis. Another name for this is a typical states method, where you you just start from some random product state, time evolve it so you get a typical state, and then carry out the calculation. And I do want to mention that this method, we didn't invent it, we just carried it in a different context, and there are some experts here, for example, Fabian, who've carried out a lot of these calculations. The result for this was actually that there was a very good match between different methods in the region where they apply. So at high temperature for the ETH method, so this is a 1 over T, this is a 1 over T plot, and indeed the methods match very, very well. One can carry out, also carry out classical dynamics, which however will fail at low temperature because of the classical limitation. Classical well, the entropy at for a classical system at zero temperature is not well defined. The advantage of this, however, is at large temperature you can do much larger systems and also see critical behavior. So the cluster sizes here were a lot bigger. The comparison to experimental data here, I'm not meaning to do any kind of a quantitative comparison. I just want to point out that, for example, in this, there's some rare experimental data on Kagome magnets. And indeed, you see this peak here in the longitudinal conductivity. It goes up here, probably because of the phonons. We have the same kind of plot here for Capella site, and here is a plot of the Hall conductivity, which is linear in field. So in principle, if one actually had all the exchange constants and everything else, one could indeed attempt some a very serious comparison with experimental data and sort out what comes from phonons and what comes from the spins. So now let me now turn to phonons and why they are important. So far, I was only talking about intrinsic spin currents, actually in infinite systems. And here I want to talk about phonons. So the reason that they might be very important, just on an accounting level, is that phonons have actually a very large contribution to transport, just because you have in three dimensions three modes per atom, whereas in you have only two modes per spins typically, and there are typically many more atoms than spins in a system. And also, phonons are expected to be strongly influenced by the interactions with the spin. And this, again, you can see very simply because the exchange interaction between two spins, the exchange strength, depends on the distance between the two spins exponentially. So that if the spins, you expect a very strong coupling because when the spins move around because of the phonons, then actually exchange constants changes dramatically. Again, some experimental motivation. Well, there's, of course, new data on cuprates in Typhoor's group, which was just published in Nature, and in particular on this the lanthanum cuprate. And there's a large, there's this anti-ferromagnetic region where there are no there's no superconductivity or even metallic behavior, and what you can actually observe is that both in the pseudo-gap phase at low doping and in the pure anti-ferromagnet, there's very very similar curves of the Hall conductivity between the two regions. So what is it common between the two? Well, one thing which is common for sure is phonons. So given the extremely good overlap between the two, might the behavior of the Hall conductivity actually come from phonons? Another very recent experiment where the role of phonons is highly likely to be important is Strandstrom titanate, where again there's some nominally very large Hall conductivity which was measured, and because this is both an insulator and also non-magnetic, it kind of seems obvious that the role of phonons should be very important. All right, so let me now turn to the theory and how to model this. Phonons are always present, especially at high temperatures. They interact with spins, as I mentioned before, and they're basically always good quasiparticles, which actually, in this case, allows us to carry out a Boltzmann calculation. Of course, including as well collision terms with other parts of the system. So the interaction Hamiltonian in general, one can write as an interaction between phonons, so some number of phonons interacting with some number of spin operators. Actually, note that the first term here, the spin term, is not permitted for Cramer's ions, but it might be permitted from non-Cramer's ions, so that you actually expect a much stronger spin phonon coupling from non-Cramer's ions, and this should remind you also of various this should be actually kind of obvious because non-Cramer's ions, the symmetries of the lattice is very important. So the idea is to proceed in perturbation theory by computing the relaxation rate of phonons and plugging that into Boltzmann equation. So how do you calculate the relaxation rates of phonons? Well, we have Fermi's golden law, which relates these basically collision terms to the transition amplitude between two states. And then in order to compute this transition amplitude, one can use Born approximations at several orders. And as was discussed in this paper, actually, the first Born approximation cannot lead to a Hall effect. Only the second Born approximation can lead to a Hall effect. And as we'll see in a second, this actually is very important because this gives you access to more complicated correlation functions. So now if you assume a single phonon process, so here in the Hamiltonian that I showed before, we only take terms which have a single phonons, and then take some operator of spins, which we call O, which may be, for example, S times S. After some algebra, you can actually show that in the first Born approximation, the transition rate, so the collision rate you should input in Boltzmann's equation, is related to correlation, OO correlation function. So you should think about the spin-spin correlation function of these correlation function of these operators. This means that actually the relaxation times of phonons gives information about the spin or energy correlations and vice versa. Okay. So by knowing about this phonon thermal conductivity, we'll see in a second, we can actually learn about the spin physics and vice versa. The reason that you can see, I don't have much time to describe this, but in any case, you can plug this into Boltzmann. This is the linear form, linearized form of Boltzmann's equation, and you can actually see that the phonon current takes this form and should vanish. The Hall conductivity should vanish because this guy is actually symmetric. So in order to get a non-zero Hall effect, one needs to go to the second Born approximation. And what one actually sees here is that one needs to the relaxation rate is now related to four-time correlation functions. This has even more structure. It's even more interesting. May even be related to these OTOC and so transport. Basically, the non-diagonal collisions can produce this Hall effect, and so maybe in the Hall effect you can extract information about higher order correlation functions. Here we've tried to apply. So there's been a lot of Leo's work has been trying to apply this calculation to this experiment here. Because we're in this very good antiferromagnet with these very large exchange constants, we can actually carry out linear spin wave theory, which allows us to compute these correlation functions, which are otherwise extremely difficult to calculate. And we expect to have final results very soon in the next few weeks. So here, I'll show my conclusions. I have 1 minute left, so I guess I can run through them. What we have done is developed a theoretical framework and methodology for the full conductivity tensor in quantum magnets. An important point is that the magnetic contribution looks very similar for at high temperatures for very different material. It is just determined by J and some lattice constants. So J is the exchange, spin exchange. And we need to look in order, because these features are so general, in order to extract any more detailed information, one needs to look more carefully at materials and models where there are strong anisotropies or other clear features. Regarding the phonon conductivity, I want to insist that phonon Hall contributions are ubiquitous, as we've seen in several recent experiments in insulating magnets. And we started a study of the effect of spins on the phonon conductivity. The scattering, which controlled the Hall effect, is different from the one that controls the longitudinal effect. That was this difference between the two-point and the four-point correlation functions. And one will expect, in particular, that there should be distinct T and H dependencies for these two types of contributions. Thank you.
Thank you for another very clear talk. Ooh, lots of questions. I think I saw you first.
Yeah, this is maybe a bit technical question, but I was intrigued by your method based on ETH, where you time evolve some random state. Can you elaborate on that? Why is it cheaper than diagonalizing the Hamiltonian? And you know, how do you set the temperature, or how do you know the temperature, for instance, of the system?
Yeah, I mean, so quantitatively, I don't know how. Well, okay. In terms of diagonalizing the Hamiltonian, you have to diagonalize the whole system, so all states, the whole spectrum. This is obviously very expensive and is, you know, scales exponentially with the size of your cluster. In this ETH method, typical states method, you just pick some random product state and then you time evolve it. In order to, and this, you know, there's some lots of papers about this eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, and the way that you extract the temperature is that you extract the entanglement entropy, and then you expect and you extract the entanglement entropy as a function of the so you can calculate the energy of the expectation value of the energy of that state. You also extract the entanglement entropy of these different states, and then temperature is related to the derivative between entropy and energy. And so this is how you determine the temperature of your system.
Thank you. I think I saw Andre next.
Lucille, so just to clarify, how different, so I understand that this part, the numerical part, is quite different in spirit from doing the sort of the part and decomposition of the spin waves. But in terms of the results, if you compare with, you know, Hoshokotsura, Nagao's work, what is different conceptually? They also formulate the current, right? And they also compute kappa x. Well, they focus on kappa x y, right?
Yes, so if because you, they can't get kappa x x actually.
That's right. So is the point here that you're trying to get the full tensor, or if you try to do kappa x y, would you get similar results as, let's say, Kotsura Nagao's Lee?
So there's several things here. So here, their method is based on a on the assumption that you have quasi-particles, which are these partons. So they assume some state, and they assume that you have some quasi-particles in this state. And so it's very specific to the fact that you actually have quasi-particles in this state. And for example, at high temperature, it would fail completely. Another aspect is that the way that they extract the current and they extract the fact that you can have a Hall conductivity is actually based on this orbital magnetization, and so this is how they write down some current. Okay, this is very, very different from what we're doing here. Right. Well, we're just deriving a current from the continuity equation.
Okay. And so not to belabor, maybe slightly different questions. You mentioned several times the spin-orbit coupling was important in this case. So could you elaborate a little bit more? Why is that the case?
That's because if you don't have spin-orbit coupling, you actually have a symmetry. So you always have the existence of some anti-unitary symmetry that makes these two that basically leads to some symmetric contribution, and the Hall conductivity is anti-symmetric. It's a little.
But let's see. So
it's it's very simple to derive, but it's a little technical to explain.
All right. Well, let's do it over coffee because Nick is looking at me angrily.
You just have.
Maybe Liang was next in the growing line.
So you showed data on the thermal Hall conductivity in strontium titanate.
Yeah, but I didn't explain this. So
right, that's exactly my question. Yeah, it's a, as you said, it's a non-magnetic insulator. So what is giving rise to the thermal Hall effect?
Well, it may be the structure of the magnon bands. That could be a possibility. Some very Berry curvature related thing. I'm not discussing this. Like I'm not trying to explain this.
Did they also say anything about this? The author of this paper?
I didn't say anything about this paper. I just showed it as motivation that phonons were important.
Okay, thanks.
If that's a satisfied customer, then next question.
So I'm a bit confused in that. So the Cooper formula is quite powerful, but usually it's hard to evaluate it. So in a quasi-particle approach, you can do diagrammatics, for example. So here you've gotten around it by using a scaling ansatz, it seems. Where does the information, so is there no information on the phase of the, it seems like the only information you have is what the operators are, what is your spin model, so it doesn't depend on anything on the phase of matter, there could be a phase transition as a function of temperature, nothing changes.
Right, so what I discussed were some scaling relations, so it's not even scaling at this point, so here you do some I guess it's some scaling relation. But so then you can extract the dependence here as a function of temperature, and then this is multiplied by a function. Okay, and the claim here is that this function at high temperature is going to be finite and it's not going to have very much. And this we actually checked with numerics.
Right. So the form factor in front, the 1 by t squared, just comes from looking at what operators go into the Cooper formula. And the integral there is the extra, like.
It's what you actually have to calculate if you want a quantitative answer, which we did with numerics.
I see, but there's no theoretical way to justify why that is independent of, let's say, temperature.
It scales like it's just going to be some finite function of this. Okay, some.
I guess if you look at the spectral decomposition, you can see what that's going to do at height.
Yeah, high temperature. So I was wondering, how does it connect to low temperature where you actually
So at low temperature, lots of things are going to come in.
Right. Okay.
I think the sequence of questions went this way. So if you could just pass the microphone down.
This might be slightly related. So in your CAGMA calculations, it seemed like at high temperature, your results are fairly generic, and it doesn't depend on what particular ground state you enter, like ordered or particular spin liquid. So at what low temperature do you have to push it, and can you push it to that regime where you get some insight into the ground state?
So at very low temperature, things are going to be governed by ground state properties. So for example, if you have a gapless system, you're going to get different scaling exponents as you go to zero temperature as a function of the thermal conductivity. So if you have, say you have a potential spin liquid and you push it to, low temperature, so I guess you need already to be in the phase that you're actually looking for, then you'll have some, you'll have, for example, some scaling behavior. In that case, if you have a gapped system, although you'll have phonons, so it's difficult to say, but it's in the gapped system, then you expect some, what is this called? Exponential. Yeah, but it has another name, but anyway. activated behavior.
So are your results primarily T equals J and higher? Is that how I should understand this?
Well, the generic results are at large temperature. So the scaling results, let's say, are at high temperature. However, if you actually can do a calculation, either analytically or numerically, this is valid everywhere.
Sure. Okay.
So this derivation, Kubo formula, has no limit, there's no problem with going to low temperature. Scaling behavior, however, is the high temperature behavior. But the generic curve should still, you know, be something at low temperature, then a peak, and then going down as 1 over t squared.
A somewhat orthogonal question. So you nicely described the coupling between the spins and the phonons, but you can sort of imagine that different eigenvectors of the phonons would couple differently to the spin system because the displacements might be flexing different exchange pathways and what have you. So were you imagining that the phonons were coupling to the spin system in some average way, and you're taking that into account, or should you preferentially weight the acoustic phonons because those ones would definitely be populated at the sort of temperatures?
Yeah, so here we're focusing on the acoustic phonons, but in terms of you can plug in. So this is just there's a tilde, but actually when you do a calculation, because I wasn't gonna write everything out here, but when you do a calculation, you can work out what the symmetries are and include all the modes that you want to be looking at, acoustic phonon modes. Just one last thing for Yang Li's question was that, so at high temperature, not too high temperature, you may be able to see some dependencies by applying different fields, etc. So the different systems and different states might have different behaviors depending on the orientation of the field. So there are things to be looked at there as well. So.
Last week, there were quite a bit of discussion on the effect of disorder on this prospective quantum spin liquid candidates.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have disorder, of course you have, then what will be basically its reflection in the thermal conductivity?
It's a difficult question. I think if you're in the same state, so if disorder keeps you still in the same state or takes you to the state you're looking for, you should still have the same generic features. So for example, if you're still in a quantum spinized ground state and you still have a photon, if disorder doesn't kill this, then you should still expect this kind of power law. What an advantage, for example, that thermal conductivity doesn't pick up local disorder in the sense of probing local disorder excitations versus a specific heat which does, because here it's only mobile excitations. So the details I don't know. The generic features I think should be similar.
I think we have another question up front.
Be more scattering, I guess.
So if you have say ordered ground state with Chernoff magnon bands.
You have ordered ground states, right?
With Chernoff magnon bands, with magnon band with Chern numbers, then mm-hmm. How does the thermal Hall effect look like qualitatively?
So you're asking about magnon bands, so this calculation, I don't know if I can say something. I guess you'll get some extra contribution to the
magnon.
To the.
You're asking about magnon.
Yeah, magnon.
Right. You probably have some extra contribution in the Hall effect. However, things are not because magnons are bosons. You have to be a little bit careful with what you expect from bosons and from fermions. So you don't expect quantized things like you do for fermions, for example.
I think we might have some talks on this later in the conference. Very quick last question from Gang.
So this is restricted to one question. So the So the first part about the high temperature thermal Hall effect, thermal conductance, as you said, is somewhat universal. And then what do we actually learn about the physical system? You know, if it is universal, like how much information we can learn about the property of the physical system?
Right. So one then has to do more detailed experiments, varying field. Probably looking at anisotropic systems so that you can actually, you know, not just look for power law, but actually more detailed features. Because otherwise, indeed, you just have 1/1 over t squared.
Okay.
So.
I'm pretty sure there's more that can be said. However, we should move on to the next talk and thank Lucille again. Also, for sticking nicely to time.